It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farrow. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, our guest has concerns about a Wisconsin school district's new personalized pathways program focusing on future careers.
First, in about a month, a new Republican-controlled Congress will be sworn in. After the most recent election, both the legislative and the executive branches will be led by the Republican Party. Last month, Wisconsin Republican Congressman Paul Ryan was unanimously renominated by fellow Republicans for another term as Speaker of the House.
House Speaker Paul Ryan joins us now to talk about his legislative priorities heading into a new Congress. Speaker Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Before we get to priorities facing Congress, let's start a little closer to home in Tomah. You and Senator Ron Johnson have expressed great concern about more problems at the Tomah VA facility. In this case, not the opioids, but mishandled equipment. What is your take on the ongoing problems there?
Well, what's so frustrating about this is Tomah has been under such a microscope, and yet they still have these terrible problems. We see persistent management failures here. And what is frustrating to myself and to Ron Johnson and others is lack of accountability at the VA writ large, but especially at Tomah. They cannot have the kind of discipline and management restructuring that is necessary to get this place whipped into shape. That is why we think we need to have more wholesale reform at the Veterans Administration so that they can really actually hold people accountable. And so that's what's so frustrating about all of this.
Is that one of your hopes for the upcoming administration and term in Congress?
It is. It's one of the things we're looking for in a new VA secretary, someone who can come in and clean out the organization, but also changing the law so that you can fire people who need to be fired and not just put them at the desk and reward them by not disciplining them. We need to hold people accountable. The bureaucracy is bloated, and it is inefficient and unaccountable, and we need to bring accountability to the VA so our veterans get the care that they deserve.
Turning to the bigger picture now, Republicans on both sides of Congress, a Republican president next year, your number one priority, day one?
Well, we've got a lot of number one priorities, I guess I'd say. The first we're going to do is start working on a budget. And in that budget, we're going to try and bring Obamacare relief. We will have a bridge or a transition period to make sure that people can get from the situation they're in, which is typically double-digit premium increases, extremely high deductibles, few choices, if any, to a better system that will replace Obamacare so that we can actually give people more choices, lower prices, so that everyone can get comprehensive quality health care regardless of whether you have a pre-existing condition or not. That's a really high priority. But also growing the economy, that's something that we're going to work on simultaneously. And two things that really kind of fit into this is cleaning up the regulatory state, which is really putting a chilling effect on job creation, and reforming your tax code to make American businesses, particularly our manufacturers, much more competitive globally so we can grow more jobs here at home and increase take-home pay and just get faster economic growth. We also have an infrastructure issue we want to address in that. We want to continue to rebuild our infrastructure. We've got a military problem, which is our military has been hollowed out quite a bit over the last few years. We need to address that as well. So as you can see, we have a full plate of issues revolving around economic growth, national security, and repealing and replacing Obamacare with something much better.
On the budget, from what you were just saying and what President-elect Trump has said, major revisions to the tax code, tax cuts for corporations and individuals, but increased spending on the military and infrastructure, so lower revenue, higher spending, doesn't that mean bigger annual deficits, a bigger overall debt burden?
Yeah, so we need to deal with the debt as well. So that means we need to have the right kind of spending reforms, spending cuts, but also when we're talking about taxes, we're going to close loopholes that make it so that we can then lower tax rates so we're more competitive. Less social engineering and special interest loopholes in the tax code placed in Washington in exchange for lower tax rates. That doesn't lower revenues. That actually gives us faster economic growth. And so what we are hoping to achieve is to make sure that we go through the budget and cut out wasteful spending, put our entitlement programs on a sustainable path in the future so that they don't create a debt crisis themselves, and get faster economic growth by stopping the special interest carve-outs in the tax code, cleaning up and simplifying our tax code so that we can tax our businesses at lower tax rates so that they're more on par with the rest of the world. What a lot of folks just don't realize is America we tax our businesses at much, much higher tax rates than our foreign competitors are taxing their businesses. And as a result, we're losing American jobs, we're losing American corporate headquarters, we're losing economic growth as a result, and we have to address that.
And then to the point of health care, we've seen talk not just about ending the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, but proposals from the incoming Department of Health and Human Services secretary, or the likely secretary, of changing Medicare, the Medicare we had in place already, funding vouchers, people have said, paying people, and then they find private insurance. Are you looking for wider changes to Medicare?
Yeah, no one's suggesting vouchers. That's really sort of a scare tactic. Right now, Medicare Advantage is a very popular program that seniors get to choose from among private plans for their comprehensive Medicare benefits. That's something seniors today enjoy. The federal employees get to choose among competing comprehensive private plans for their benefit so that they have more choices and lower prices. Those are the kinds of reforms that are being discussed for younger people. It's very important to note that any discussion of Medicare, those changes do not affect anyone in or near retirement. So anybody who's on Medicare today or about to go on Medicare is not a part of this conversation. It's really for people like in my generation, the X generation on down, where we're not going to have a Medicare program if we don't reform it for our generation for when we retire, because the Medicare trust fund goes bankrupt at the end of the next decade. We have to acknowledge that and prepare for it. And the sooner we do that, the more likely we can guarantee that no change occurs for people in or near retirement, and that the next generation, the people in their early 50s and 40s, will actually have a program for when they retire. So I think what you're hearing is what we call Medi-scare tactics, Medi-scare politics, suggesting that there's going to be some big benefit change for people who are already on the program. That's not in the cards. No one's discussing that. And I think that's sort of scare tactics 101 that's occurring today. But it's very important that we preserve this probably most important program. I put Medicare and Social Security up there on the top of the list of the most valuable and important programs we have in our country. And so we want to make sure that they work the best that they can possibly work and that they're solvent so people can continue to rely on these programs.
Talking to House Speaker Paul Ryan, Congressman from Wisconsin. I want to turn to the world stage, Speaker Ryan. A big international trend, more and more countries turning to some form of economic nationalism, retreating from global free trade, a lot of opposition to that, a rise of what people call strongman governments, autocratic governments. What do you want to see from the United States when it comes to world leadership, given these trends?
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation, and I think that there is a lot of that occurring around the world. What I would like to see America do is lead the world in showing what a competitive, lean government looks like. What we ought to be doing is cleaning up our economic policy so that we are the best and that we can compete extremely well. Getting our regulatory state so that we have smart regulations. Getting our tax code in shape so that we are competitive. And showing the rest of the world what free enterprise and global leadership looks like. But being strong economically, we can be strong in every other sense of the word. Not just a strong person, but a strong country with healthy economy, with strong companies that are in America building, selling, exporting, and engaging in the world and pushing the values of freedom and free enterprise. That, to me, is what American leadership needs to look like, and there is never a time where it's as more important today than now, I think, given the kind of pressures you see coming from Russia and China and around the world.
Last week we talked to Richard Painter. He was an ethics counsel in the George W. Bush administration, the last Republican administration. He raised concerns about possible conflicts of interest for President-elect Trump, saying that if he doesn't divest himself from the Trump Organization, if he's, in effect, profiting from foreign powers, he would be in violation of the emoluments, I can't pronounce the word, clause in the Constitution. And he said that the House of Representatives would take the lead, need to take the lead in policing that, in effect. Is that something you're going to be watching for?
Yeah, well, of course we're going to do the kind of oversight that we're supposed to do as Article I powers of government. Separation of powers requires that the legislative branch of government conducts oversight over all aspects of the executive branch. And the second point I would make is we have a incoming president who is an extremely successful businessman. That's kind of new for us. Typically, we elect a senator or a governor or someone like that. So this is just going to take some adjustment, which is you have a very successful businessman who is coming into the White House. I have every bit of confidence that he's going to properly divest himself and remove himself from his business affairs as he enters the Oval Office and transfer his business onto, I assume, his children or whatever he's going to do. But I have every bit of confidence that he will successfully remove himself from his business affairs as he enters this new stage.
And finally, coming out of the elections, once again, we see we're a pretty divided country, pretty divided state here in Wisconsin, along partisan lines, not just partisan lines either. What are your hopes for bipartisan, if not cooperation, civility at the least?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. We are a bitterly divided country. In Wisconsin, we know this. I mean, we've had some pretty ugly, tough elections, this one and the last few. My hope is that we focus on results and goals. We disagree often, vigorously, on how to achieve a goal. But do we want to get people out of poverty? Do we want faster economic growth? Do we want the debt to be taken care of? Do we want to be safe and secure? Yes, we do. We all want that. Liberal progressives and conservatives want that. So we will vigorously disagree with each other on the means to achieve these shared goals. So let's put it all in perspective. Treat each other well with civility and focus on outcomes and results. And that, to me, is kind of where my emphasis is going to be, focusing on the result we are trying to achieve on behalf of everyone in this country. And that is, in my opinion, the best way to proceed so that we can try to heal our country, bring some civil discourse back to our politics, which has been lacking very clearly, so that we can focus on shared goals and outcomes for our country and our fellow citizens.
We'll leave it there for now. Speaker Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet, Rob. Have a good one.
That was House Speaker Paul Ryan, Republican congressman from Wisconsin's 1st District, which includes Janesville. He joined us to talk about his legislative priorities heading into a new session of Congress. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a Harvard psychologist introduces the idea of emotional agility and says the way we deal with our emotions is a key to success in life.
First, last week we talked about big changes coming to high schools in Madison, new approach to the high school experience. A program called Personalized Pathways calls for students to choose a particular career-oriented pathway, then spend the high school years focused on courses in that area with their Pathways cohort.
Students would take core subjects like math and English in two electives, but they'll focus on thematic classes. The plan is part of a move to close the achievement gap and help students prepare for life after high school. Next year, 4 Madison high schools will offer pathways related to health careers. Ultimately, the goal is to have every high school student enrolled in a pathway.
Last week, the superintendent of the Madison Metropolitan School District joined us to talk about the plan.
Michelle Mouton is with us now. She is a professor of history at UW-Oshkosh. She's the parent of 2 children in the Madison Metropolitan School District, and she has some concerns about personalized pathways. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Michelle, we'll get into the details, but in broad strokes, what do you think of Madison Metropolitan School District's upcoming Personalized Pathways plan?
Well, I think I'm echoing the concerns of lots of parents and even teachers in the district who are concerned about the nature of Personalized Pathways and the way that it's being rolled out in the high schools right now. We are concerned, first and foremost, well, first of all, that it's not clear to us that it's going to address the problem or fix the problem of the well-documented achievement gap that it's supposed to fix. There don't seem to be any peer-reviewed studies that actually show that that would happen, and especially we're concerned that it wouldn't happen without increased support services for students. And then secondarily, we're concerned about the fact that we think the children who are being called upon, namely eighth graders, to decide whether they want to be in these pathways are too young to be making big decisions about their careers.
And let's talk about the data you're looking for. You say there's not enough research showing that this is something that will help close the achievement gap. And Superintendent Cheatham, she was with us last Friday, and she said that this is an equity measure, but do you agree that something is needed to try to close the achievement gap?
I do definitely agree that they have well documented that there's an achievement gap in the Madison high schools. And I think everybody recognizes that there's a problem and that something needs to be done to improve it. I think one of the concerns, though, is that the problem is different in the different high schools, and so perhaps the best solution is not a one-size-fits-all kind of solution for all the high schools.
You said that there's no proof that this would work without adding support services. If there were support services to be added as a complement to the plan, would you be a supporter of it?
Well, I would still be concerned that it is asking students who are 13 and 14 years old to be making decisions about their careers. I think that one of the great things about our high school system is that it allows students to learn about a lot of different things and sort of dream big and think about all different fields and all different subject matters. And I think this is really narrowing down what their opportunities are in high school, but also it may limit their post-graduation opportunities.
What about the problem that Superintendent Cheatham referenced last week, that students and focus groups and parents sometimes say they don't see the connection between the curriculum that the students are doing, the classes they're taking, and the life that happens and the jobs and college that happens after high school, and this being a way to address that?
Well, I have two responses to that. First of all, I think it's not always a reliable thing to ask students if they see the relevance of what they're learning. I think it's the responsibility of educators to figure out what students need to learn and teach them to think and to read and to do math and science, even if they can't figure out exactly what the relevance of it is in their wider life. So I don't think it's necessarily a good thing to ask students what they think they want to learn. They might pick recess, for example, and that's really not what we want them to be doing all the time. Secondarily, I think the world is changing, and we know that the world is changing very fast, and the job market is changing very fast. And I think we need to train our students to be adaptable to all kinds of things and allow them to pursue all kinds of opportunities, because we just don't know what the world's going to look like, and we don't know exactly what will be relevant to them and the jobs that they need later.
We're talking with Michelle Mouton right now, professor of history at UW-Oshkosh, also the parent of two children in the Madison Metropolitan School District. And we're talking about her concerns, and she says other parents as well, about the Madison Metropolitan School District's new Personalized Pathways program, which is set to begin next year at four Madison high schools. And I want to ask you about the idea of tracking now. The school district has said Personalized Pathways is not tracking the kind of practice of locking kids into a vocational or a college track. Do you agree with that?
I think I realize that they are claiming that they are not tracking them, and that it's not vocational education. But in fact, what they're trying to do is train them in this first pathway that they're rolling out the first year in health services. And it's linking history, English, and science so that they're all relevant to that, and it's filling part of their very few electives in a class that would be tied to health services. And I think that is, to some degree, tracking. It's eliminating the possibility of filling in all those other electives with, you know, music and art and languages, and it's not leaving open a lot of other fields that students should be able to experiment with when they're in high school.
What about whether students were offered the option of switching pathways? So they start in one and we're told that they'll be able to switch later on. Does that satisfy you?
I think it's good if they can switch later, it's unclear how that's going to be possible, but I would also point out that they have said very clearly that you won't be able to join a pathway later. So if you opt out of it, for example, if you decide not to do this health services pathway your freshman year and you become a junior and really are interested in health services, you can't then join it. So they are trying to create a cohort that's going to stick together the whole time. And, you know, it's not going to be flexible where you can get on again, off again, or get into a different pathway if you join the wrong one to start with.
Now, you've said that you're concerned about the level of parent involvement in this plan, namely that you think there wasn't enough and that it sounds like it moved to you rather hastily. What could the school district have done, if anything, do you think, to roll this plan out differently?
Well, I think there needs to have been a lot more discussion about it so that parents could have had an influence and could have given their opinions and perhaps helped the schools think about, or the MMSD think about, what you know, makes sense. I don't think one size fits all with all the high school. They're very, very different high schools. And, you know, I don't think you can just come up with one system and throw it into all four high schools. I think you need to talk to the teachers and the students and the teachers and the parents in each high school and try to figure out, based on that population and those that program, how to fit it to the schools. West, to give you, you know, West is exceeding expectations on the most recent report card and, you know, has a 92.6% graduation rate. So it doesn't seem like that would call for completely changing the way the West High School is structured, which is not at all to say that I don't think something very dramatic should be done for the 8% that are not thriving, but I don't necessarily think we need to change the entire system for that.
But if something is going right at West High School, doesn't it make sense to try to bring more students on board from different parts of Madison who might not be able to be part of that, maybe based on where they live?
Yes, but that's not what they're planning to do. They're planning to change West and all of the other schools. They're not trying to add, you know, they're not trying to make the other schools accommodate this system. They're trying to change the entire thing, and I don't think we have any data that suggests that this will actually improve West, the West system.
Now, Madison Metropolitan Schools District, they've said they'll evaluate the success of the program in about a year and a half into the program, decide whether or not to go forward. Does that evaluation timetable give you any peace of mind about the flexibility of the program and the chance for parent input?
Well, it depends. I mean, if they're going to evaluate it in 2 years, they will have rolled out potentially two of their pathways. They won't really know whether it works until they get at least 4 years out so they can see whether the students who've been through the pathway are actually succeeding. And my fear is if they keep rolling them out, you know, they will at the same time be shrinking down the options for everybody else in the high school who are not in a pathway. So it would make me and I think many other people feel better if they rolled out one and then watched to see what happens and see if it actually does help narrow the achievement gap of the students who are in that program and whether it does actually help all the students and raise the high school experience for them before they start rolling out more and more of them. Thus,
Michelle, we leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
That was Michelle Mouton, professor of history at W. Oshkosh, talking about her concerns about the Madison School District's new personalized pathways program.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the federal government rejected the Dakota Access Pipeline route. We'll find out why some activists still aren't ready to celebrate.
First, if you've ever gotten stuck on a negative emotion for hours or days or longer, or if you do your best to completely ignore those negative emotions, our next guest says you're not doing yourself any favors.
She says our emotions, positive and negative, can give us a lot of useful information about where we are in life and help us in our relationships and our careers, but only if we know how to read them.
The key is something she calls emotional agility. And the good news, she says, we can learn it and we can practice it.
Susan David joins us now. She's a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, and her new book is called Emotional Agility: Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with your term, emotional agility. What is it?
So how we navigate our inner thoughts, our emotions, and the stories that we tell ourselves drive everything in our lives. How we parent, what jobs we apply for, how we live, our relationships, and so on. And emotional agility is effectively the ability to be with those thoughts, emotions, and stories in a way that allows us to notice them, to derive use from them, but also to not let them sabotage our ability to act in ways that are congruent with our goals and our values.
Let's talk about the opposite and the problem that we're solving here, the idea of emotional rigidity. What does that look like? What's going on in our minds when we're not emotionally agile?
So often people drive their behaviors with effectively their thoughts and emotions. So we get hooked into ways of being. For example, we might feel that we are being undermined in a meeting and therefore automatically shut down. or our spouse says something and we walk out of the room. So emotional inagility is when our thoughts, our emotions, and our stories effectively call the shots, as opposed to other ways of being and acting that are more values congruent and more connected with how we truly want to be in the world.
It seems like there's a lot of emphasis in our culture today on the positive, on focusing almost exclusively on the positive, and sometimes there's that other aspect. If you focus on the positive, you attract the positive. And so as a result, it seems like sometimes we're not really supposed to acknowledge the negative stuff. What do you think about that?
So I think that this narrative in our culture is not serving us. I don't think it's serving our resilience. I don't think it's serving our well-being. If we look at, for example, that by 2030, the World Health Organization predicts that depression, not heart disease, not diabetes, not cancer, depression will be the leading cause of disability globally, it is frightening. And this narrative, I believe, around let's just be happy, we can all choose our happiness, let's be positive all the time, I think that in many ways that actually undercuts our ability to be resilient. And I'll give you an example. We know that life's beauty is inseparable from its fragility. Things might be going well today, but we might be and are very likely in our lives to be beset by illness or job loss or things that are difficult. And unless we are able to actually be skilled at understanding, labeling, dealing with these negative experiences in a way that is true and real and that actually helps us, we're not likely to be effective. So there's a growing body of research, for example, showing that people who overly focus on trying to be happy and think positive actually over time become less happy. A friend of mine who recently died of stage 4 breast cancer said that for her it felt like the tyranny of positivity, that she was ill and dying and everyone around her kept on saying, just be positive, just be positive. And she said to me, you know, if it was just a case of being positive, the friends in my stage 4 breast cancer support group would be alive today. And by keeping on getting this messaging that I've just got to be positive, what it starts to do is it starts to almost blame me for my own death. So for many reasons, I think that this emphasis on being positive and being happy don't serve us and are just not true to the reality, which is that our so-called negative emotions are core to our evolutionary way of being in the world, and we need to learn how to be effective with them.
We're talking to Susan David. Her new book is called Emotional Agility, and you write, Susan, that we're not just born with or without emotional agility. We can learn it. We can train in it, and you kind of lay out steps to figuring out our emotions, building a better relationship with them. Step one, you say, is showing up. What do you mean by that?
So often when people are experiencing difficulties, they do one of two things. The first is bottling. Bottling is where people push emotions aside. They'll say something like, I'm unhappy in my job, this relationship isn't going well, but at least I've got a job or a relationship, so I'm just not going to think about it. On the other hand, we can often do what looks like the opposite, which is to brood. And brooding is where we get so immersed in our difficult experiences. Why am I feeling what I'm feeling? This is terrible. This is awful. That we struggle to move forward. Now, what's fascinating is that even though bottling and brooding look so different, both of them are associated with lower levels of well-being, high levels of depression, high levels of anxiety over time. So one of the first things that I talk about in emotional agility is that even though there is this cultural narrative around being positive and being happy, that it's really important to show up to our difficult experiences by not trying to jostle with them, not trying to argue with whether we should or shouldn't have them, I should be happy, I shouldn't be happier, but to rather end any struggle that we have internally by dropping the rope, to notice our thoughts and emotions with compassion and curiosity and see what surfaces for us.
So if I'm having a negative emotion, you say I should just acknowledge that, you know, I'm having this negative emotion and I'm going to see what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, difficult emotions, our emotions are data. Our emotions, even the more difficult emotions, have evolved to help us to survive as a species and to shape our behavior. And so while our so-called negative emotions are not directions, they are still data. They are data, not directions. And so often beneath our difficult emotions are signs to things that we care about. I've never met someone with depression who isn't at some level concerned about how do I better be in the world? Someone who is maybe a guilty parent who isn't at some level concerned about presence and connectedness with their children, or whose idea has been stolen at work, who isn't concerned about issues of equity and fairness. So often beneath our difficult emotions are signs to things that we value. And if we can pay attention to those data, not directions, we start being able to surface things that are truly meaningful and important and to use that information in critical ways in our lives.
So once we identify those emotions, that kind of takes us to our next step, which you call stepping out. And you reference a point that we are not Mr. Spock from Star Trek with a completely dispassionate view, but we can kind of try to be and say, why? What is this emotion? What does it mean? How do we kind of step outside our emotions and analyze, as you say, what information they're trying to give us?
So absolutely. You know, so often when we are hooked, when we are emotionally inagile, we are being driven by our emotions and thoughts. And so stepping out is really this capability that we all have to really discern, you know, who's in charge here, the thinker or the thought? Who's in charge, the emotion, the fear that's telling me to not apply for a job or to shut down or to be angry, or me, the person who is big enough to experience all of my emotions? And all of your listeners will have had this experience of, say, being really angry with a customer service agent and wanting to yell down the telephone, and simultaneously having that ability to helicopter above their thoughts and emotions and saying to themselves, I feel really angry, but yelling is going to get me nowhere. So there are key ways, and in emotional agility, I describe some of these as to how we can develop the skill set. I can give two quick examples.
Sure.
The first is that so often when we experience difficult emotions, we might use very broad brushstrokes to describe how we're feeling. So we'll come home from work and we'll say, oh, I was stressed today. I was stressed. And the next day, how was your day? I was stressed. There is a very big difference between being stressed versus disappointed, stressed versus angry, stressed versus I thought I would be in a different place in my career or in my life. And what we know from the research is that people who say to themselves, what are two other options? What are two other things that I might be experiencing here? Become more able to really look at and be effective with their emotions. And we know that when people are more nuanced, not using these very broad brushstrokes, that it enables them to have, again, better levels of psychological health, but it also activates what is called the readiness potential in our brains. If I know that the real reason I'm stressed is because I thought that I'd be in a different place in my career, what it starts to do is it starts to actually shape our capacity to set goals in that area. So that's the first way that we can start to step out. A very quick second way is that so often when we are angry, we say to ourselves, I am angry, I am stressed, I am anxious. And what we're doing when we do that is we are effectively identifying 100% of who we are with that emotion. I'm angry, I'm stressed. And a very simple strategy, which all of your listeners can use, is to simply notice the thought or feeling for what it is. I'm noticing the thought that I'm being undermined. I'm noticing the feeling that I'm angry. Now, it sounds really simplistic, but what that starts to do is it starts to create space between you and the action that you take. This very critical pause that we as human beings need to be able to cultivate.
We're talking to Susan David. Her new book is Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about emotional agility and how we can build it in ourselves? Do you feel like you've been guided by your emotions for better or worse? Do you feel like you've gotten better at understanding your own emotions over the years? What did you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking about emotional agility with Susan David. She says we can learn a lot from our emotions and use them as signposts in our lives instead of getting locked into long-term negative emotions.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Have you gotten hooked into negative messages about yourself? Have you broken out of that? Do you bottle up emotions or brood over them? Do you have questions about how emotional agility works? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller right now. We've got Joe joining us in Watertown. Joe, hi.
Hi. I just came to a new thought when I was listening. The guest mentioned the nuanced thought and how that connects to our theory on the brain. I forget the term she mentioned, readiness, I think, for the brain. Now, I wonder if the guest has ever looked at or is interested in looking into what we discussed a lot here about politics and how people get worked up emotionally over the so-called fake news and other news sites that have spread a lot of stuff that gets people angry and very emotional. And I found that interesting when she mentioned the word nuanced, because we always think of nuanced thought versus some of the quite non-nuanced thought that you see people is when they spouse a quick thing they see online, and it's a generalization, maybe something like, you know, all these illegals are taking our jobs or something like that, and they walk around with a simple thought process and an anger behind that, and that the nuanced thought is not there. And that could be partly why people that properly vet and do the research and are more educated are not getting this emotion, because they're putting it into proper proportion.
Joe, thanks for that comment. Appreciate it. And Susan, he's kind of getting there at sort of seeing things as black and white or binary. You're mad or you're not mad. Things are going well or they're not. And you're tying into politics there. But is there something to the complexity of emotions and being able to see them in different ways?
Absolutely. I think that was just a brilliant question. And it is something that I talk about in emotional agility, how as human beings, we are so often drawn to what in psychological terms is called premature cognitive commitment. The idea that we very quickly want to put ourselves and other people in categories. So sometimes we do this in ways that don't really impact us. You know, I don't eat from mezes in Turkey. We create a little story about ourselves and it becomes comforting. But of course, we see this in more pernicious ways when it comes to quickly putting people into boxes, stereotypes, categorizations, and so on. And we know absolutely that one of the ways that we become more effective as human beings is to start trying to dig out a little bit more. So to move away from this idea that I am just the first thing that I think, and to really open our hearts and our minds up to being more curious. One of the things that I actually talk about in the book, and I think it relates absolutely to this question as well, and it's fairly frightening, is how us as human beings, how we are comforted by narratives that we hear time and time again. And so what happens is when there is a narrative, even if that narrative is fake, even if that narrative doesn't serve us, when we hear something time and time again, our brains start to see that narrative as being, therefore it is truthful, and therefore it's something that I should act on. And so in emotional agility, I talk about how people get even sucked into comforting relationships that don't serve them, or comforting jobs that they've been in for years and years and years, but that are going nowhere. So, yes, we absolutely construct these narratives. We are often bound by them, and the only way we can start becoming more effective is when we start recognizing them for what they are and start trying to surface our values. How do I really want to be in the world? How do I want to come across? Is this narrative something that is congruent with the way I truly want to live my life?
Talking to Susan David about her new book, Emotional Agility. Back to our callers now with Aiden in Green Bay. Aiden, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about Aiden?
I wanted to just personally leave a comment as far as my personal experiences go. I'm actually just turned 19 years old, started my freshman year of college, and I've been in therapy for 6 or 7 years for a lot of just rough stuff at home. And one of the things, we didn't call it emotional agility, we called it like resiliency, but, you know, being able to intelligently handle your emotions, I feel like has changed my life significantly. I mean, to a point where I feel like overall I'm a much better person. In fact, I just found out today that my dog is, the ACL tear that we thought she had is actually an advanced form of cancer. And so that has to be my final week. So, you know, being able to handle that appropriately, I think, is just, you know, a skill that just, I think, I wish it was taught more in school, you know, along the way, because it's so completely invaluable.
Aiden, thanks for sharing that. I'm glad you feel like you're dealing better with emotions. Sorry about your dog. Good luck with that, and good luck with finals week. But Aiden, saying, Susan, this is a skill, and it's made a big difference for him in dealing with these, in learning these emotional skills.
Yeah, these are critical skills. I mean, these skills drive every single aspect of our lives. And I, firstly, you know, congratulate Aiden for the grace and courage and dignity that it takes to, you know, recognize that you maybe aren't dealing with something as effectively and to start to cultivate some of the capacity in this area, because so much of it is learnable. The other thing that I just wanted to say in relation to his comment about it being taught, I could not agree more. When we start seeing the rates of depression, anxiety, and difficulty, and how these are growing exponentially in young children and in young adults, it's frightening. I recently wrote an article, or was interviewed for an article in the New York Times called Teaching Your Child Emotional Agility. And in it, what I speak about is how so often as parents, we want to, you know, protect our children from difficulties. And we'll run in and try to save them from difficulties, what I call emotional helicoptering. And yet the only way as children we can start to develop skills around emotions is by being allowed to experience difficulty, by being encouraged to label our emotions, by being encouraged to think about our values and what's important to us, and by being encouraged to shape our behaviors and choose actions. One, you know, very beautiful quotation that's been attributed to Viktor Frankl and that I talk about in emotional agility, especially in the context of raising children, is this idea that between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our power to choose. And it's in that choice that comes our growth and freedom. And so often in everyday life, at work, at home, from when we're younger to when we're older, we respond on autopilot. And emotional agility is effectively this ability to be compassionate and kind with ourselves, but to also recognize that our emotions don't need to call the shots, to create that space, to be able to create that learning and growth. This is critical.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
I am so grateful to be here. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Susan David, psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School and the author of the new book, Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. And we have a link to her Emotional Agility quiz over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Didn't have a chance yet to go and take the quiz. I think I'll do it. And when you go to find that link, tell us if you have a story, if you were raised or brought up your kids to try to deal with their emotions in the way our guest is talking about, if you've made a change in your life along those lines. If you want to share, you can even tell us how you did on the quiz. I don't know if it's graded A, B, C, or what, but let us know. On last week's edition of Food Friday, we got a lot of great advice on making soup with Kathy Gunst, author of the book Soup Swap.
So what did we do this weekend as, I guess, highly suggestible radio hosts? We both made soup, apparently.
Yeah, we're that suggestible. And I like making soup.
Well, also, it was snowy. I made mine yesterday. I don't know when you made yours, but it was
Saturday.
It was totally soup weather. And how could you? You almost could not make soup.
Right. What soup did you make?
I made cream of tomato with tortellini pasta in it, cheese tortellini pasta. And I used her advice, and I did not cook it in the soup.
Right. You cooked it separately,
right,
then put it in. I did a chicken, rice, and carrot soup. I had gotten a rotisserie chicken. Then I made stock with the remnants of the chicken, so that I did follow her advice there. The rice had been cooked previously separate, and, you know, the big curse is you cook it in there, it soaks up all the liquid, it became stew.
And from stew, right.
I had the problem. I put in too much rice. So by this morning when I ate it, the leftovers for lunch today, it was stew. But I like stew, too.
Chicken,
so that's okay.
Stew is not a bad thing.
Right.
The important thing is, I mean, I'm impressed that you made your own stock. I've still never done that.
I do that. You know, I get the rotisserie chicken, taking the easy way out. But then I'm like, okay, I'll make up for it. I'll, like, boil that down and make some stock with it. And yeah, it came out pretty good. Yours was good, right?
I haven't even had mine yet.
What?
It's dinner tonight.
Doesn't make a lick of sense. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.